Blog Talk Radio.
Deepen our understanding of the Freemasonry and hopefully be entertained at the same time. And I'm not always convinced that Freemasonry happens if the most, the end game is to do the most. I'm not always sure. I tend to think the purpose, the frankness of it's about our understanding. And I come to this conclusion, perhaps it's taking things out of context, you decide, but there is a part of, in the work where we're asked a question, where were you first? In my heart. This tells us that this wasn't necessarily something that was the indication is it's not entirely an intellectual pursuit, that the heart speaks to us about some form of emotional commitment, emotional well-being. Benchmark. That tells us it is a simple part, but I think it is like a lot of early element, quite profound. And I tend to think that if we mine these things, we find there's treasures to be found, treasures that will take us in the direction of development and understanding that we have thought. Today, like other days here, the acquired taste that I think Freemasonry represents continues. A balance of some civility, contemplation, an opportunity to put things in context in a particular way. There is a lot of things going on across Canada and across North America, a lot of interesting things related to Masonry, opportunity for our scholars to share ideas. Until you form that moment when you develop your own ideas, perhaps, or you simply utterly enjoy the presentations. Here, I tend to think of that more as a spectator sport rather than participation. And I think Freemasonry truly is a participatory act in some ways. I mean, life isn't a rehearsal, it's real. And we want, how do we hasten that moment of insight? You know, I've spoken about the upsell constant. And I think if we haven't stopped and trying to deepen the experience of Freemasonry, if we haven't said that's enough, then I feel justified in trying to share understanding and process with you, this process of discovery. Inspiration, a big part. I think you're going to like the commentary today, the daunting task of organizing thinking, and the poetry today, the poet today is Ralph Waldo Emerson. Yeah, he's an interesting guy. Interesting. And the references to him, fabulous. We're going to jump into his poem, Nature. But before we get into that, a little bit of music to calm the soul, to focus us all. And you can fill up your espresso or your Merlot or Pinot Noir whiskey and sit back and join us just briefly for the acquired taste and sonic effects. A little something from Joe Pass, an homage to Django Reinhardt, of course. Thank you. That works. That works. Boston thought that what motivates us to become Masons isn't always obvious, but in an ideal environment, in an ideal context, it's character development. I like the poet that was selected today, Emerson. You know, recall the Delphi Oracle and the importance of the message, know thyself. Well, Emerson took it in another direction. Trust thyself. Interesting guy. Let's just put a pin in that one. Inspiration. I don't think we can do the same thing over and over again and expect it to be inspiring. But here, what it is. The process of being mentally stimulated to do or feel something, especially to do something creative. The process. It's not somebody telling us what to do or the infamous upsell. It's a process. Or the quality of being inspired. A rare moment of inspiration in an otherwise dull display. A person or thing that inspires. He is an inspiration to everyone. Funny that. I have, like you, a number of people paraded in front of me telling me that these people are inspirational. And truly, after a while, they're just faces. It's almost like a mob of people that are, and usually it's that they've achieved some economic stability, and that's to be inspirational, or for an act of philanthropy, and that's to be inspirational. But where I am, we really don't go much further than that. And to be honest with you, that just doesn't seem genuine to me after all this time. It's people that endure that I find, and I think many people, I do, around the world find inspirational. Oh, if you're approaching this program with the element of umbrage, well, that's just too tedious for this kind of conversation. Inspiration. To truly, that you think of yourself as a man, as a human being. Who are those characters over the course of civilization and perhaps beyond, that take us to another level of understanding, of awareness? Am I being too narrow and guided in my interpretation of what inspiration is? No, I am. I think we particularly here because we're students of symbolism, that even inspirational figures are symbols of deeper meaning that trigger that process of being stimulated. But not because somebody else wants you to be stimulated. You can't force it or make it. But we sure can make our environments conducive. We sure can. Not to replace what we already have. There needs to be a gentility to what we're about to discover and construct. These are add-ons, additions, if you will, that strengthen the foundation of our order. Certainly now we're in a particular part of the world that's transcending our brief history. We're inviting and living with people that are well educated and experienced. You can't always separate out the two, but the one has to do with self-discipline. Here, this is a commentary. See what you think. If you could explain it to me, I'd really be most appreciative. Once, long before you and me were born, ideas were being exchanged somewhere, somehow. Ideology grew when new ideas made people restless. Searching for the easy path was the way most learned to resolve their conflicts. Simple. Simple until ideas were dissected and shown to have complexity, nuance. The spread of ideas did not and still does not happen uniformly. Wherever we are at the ragged edge of learning. Testing our resolve is the surge of the radically new. We could call it resistance, but that would ignore the way people absorb innovation by digesting and adapting. Always, innovation is welcomed by some, resisted by others, coming on as a growing storm of change. Or a gentle rain. From the first wavering chill to winds that scream and darkness that consumes lightness, the experience is even individual. I remember well that there was a man who ran for and failed to gain election to the highest political office of our land. We claimed humans walked with dinosaurs. It frightened me that this was a man who spoke for a section of the nation ready to argue speciously the merit of belief over fact. Until those thoughtful men leaned into conversation around their small table to relax, to reason, to confidently explore their disagreements, what later became a movement was shifting, colliding like tectonic plates underfoot, unseen and always floating. Reason broke through, but did not remove barriers of tribalism, show us a new reality of dream fulfillment, ridding mankind of tensions by shifting attitudes and growing confidence. Entrance to those tables required intelligence to share evidence, physical and metaphysical. And as they did, we did. Freemasonry offered an accommodation, not replacement, a means to navigate superstition and manipulation, a way to think about invention and change with the goal of something called happiness. Irreligious to pious. Respectful of questions that we put to ourselves about purpose and meaning. Invincible Art Tatum at piano. It's joined by Ben Webster on tenor sax and Red Cullender on bass. Shit happens when like-minded people sit down together. Something quite remarkable. Quite remarkable. And I hope you're sitting back comfortable. We're going to take this matter of inspiration perhaps a step further. Let's share with you a poem by a fellow that was born in 1803, Boston, Massachusetts. And he was interesting, an essayist, one of those interesting people that hardly seems logical that they could exist. But he was studying at Harvard and teaching for a time, and then he entered the ministry. And life was going on until the death of his 19-year-old wife. She died of TB. He was young. And he resigned from the church. A man of conscience, yeah? And then you can see the need for healing. He left for Europe, and he visited Thomas Carlyle, the writer, Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Now, Carlyle, as we know, he's Scottish-born English writer. He was famous for his explosive attacks on hypocrisy and materialism and his distrust of democracy and his highly romantic belief in the power of the individual. And he influenced Emerson. And the insights of the Scottish writer helped Emerson formulate his own philosophy. So when he came back to New England, he got married again in 1835, and he settled in Concord, Massachusetts. And he became the chief spokesman for transcendentalism. It's a term you and I have heard, very popular in the 70s and 80s, as a meditative process. I have a friend who's quite invested and benefited greatly. And he became part of that whole notion. Perhaps the best expression of transcendentalism is the belief that everything in our world, even a drop of dew, is a microcosm of the universe. He had this concept of the oversoul, a supreme mind that every man and woman share, allowed transcendentalists to disregard external authority and to rely instead on direct experience. Trust thyself. Now that alone, and this man's thinking, influenced some notable writers, Bronson Alcott, Margaret Fuller, Henry David Thoreau, and W.E. Channing. And he had a journal that he edited, a quite famous journal. It was called The Dial. Yeah. So, unfortunately, Emerson died of pneumonia in 1882. Nah. But he was not without his pundits, and he was a steady optimist, which I really do enjoy. His refusal to grant the existence of evil caused Herman Melville and Nathaniel Hawthorne and Henry James Sr., among others, to doubt his judgment. And they were, in spite of his skepticism, unable to change Emerson's beliefs that are a central importance in the history of American culture. This is a piece he wrote from his complete works that was edited in 1904. It's called From Elements and Mottos, Nature. A subtle chain of countless rings, the next onto the furthest brings. The eye reads omens where it goes and speaks all languages, the rose. And striving to be man, the worm mounts through all the spires of form. The rounded world is fair to see, nine times folded into mystery. Though baffled seers cannot impart the secret of its laboring heart, throb thine with nature's throbbing breast, and all is clear from east to west. Spirit that lurks each form within beckons to spirit of its kin. Self-kindled, every atom glows and hints the future which it owes. Thank you. Did you have an opportunity to sit back with Miles Davis and to not let your thoughts drift? I don't think it's possible. I really don't. He's a remarkable performer. Struggled with his demons, though, and a remarkable performer. Where do we not struggle? Is there anyone out there that doesn't? In some way, maybe not quite so famously as Mr. Davis. I'm drawn to introduce our portion of the show on symbolism by referencing something that I read and from the 1935 minutes of the annual communication of the Grand Lodge of Canada. Grand Lodge of Ancient and Free and Accepted Masons of Canada. And this was from the address by the Grand Master, Frank Armitage Coppice, Most Worshipful Brother. And it was, what captured me, why would I ever share something from something so obscure with the audience of Masonic Effects? Well, just read it to you and draw your own conclusion. He points out that this is our 80th annual gathering, to be within measurable distance of the close of 40 years of Masonic effort at the grand jurisdiction should give us pause. I suggest that we will rejoice in what has been accomplished in those 80 years. I suggest that we may well bow ourselves in humble and grateful thanksgiving to the great architect of the universe, whose tender mercies to us, ward, have been so manifest. I suggest that we may well look with confident expectation to a future that should hold every promise for the fraternity. I like the idea that the promise is ahead of us, not behind us. But, and here's where we drill into the idea a bit more of the man. I suggest also The thought that we may well pause to take stock, to ask ourselves, quo vadis, whither goest thou? And whither the craft we love so well to seek, if perchance we may find wherein we have failed to measure up to the noblest and the best that Freemasonry has to offer. Perhaps in such a quest we shall make some surprising, some discerning discoveries. And if we do so, shall we not mark this important occasion by a new, a real rededication to Freemasonry and to the promulgation in public and private life of those principles of belief and conduct for which it stands? I would that you and I might here and now seek, if haply we might recapture that white flame, that first fine rapture of devotion that characterized our entry to the craft. I would that each of us, from the Grand Master to the latest tenured apprentice, might catch a new, a nobler vision. I would that you and I might realize in all humility and yet in all its amplitude the opportunity and the responsibility that now lie to our hands, might grasp the fact that as good citizens we are called to play an important, perhaps a decisive part in one of the great evolutionary crises in the history of our race. Who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Thus much may well be said, that it is no light thing to be a man among men in the year 1935. It is a challenge to the best that is in us, a challenge to our manhood, to our fortitude, to our imagination, and to our faith. Not he who has never trembled in the face of imminent danger, but he who conquers his fear and presses forward is the truly brave man. And if to each of us in these trying days have come our moments of doubt and perhaps of despair, and what thinking man has not had such experiences of late, it is surely for us as good Masons and good citizens of Ontario to face forward with courage, with faith and with imagination. For as Masons, we are thrice armed in that we are avowed followers of the only doctrine of life that offers a permanent solution to the problems that trouble mankind. Permanent solution. The world is deluged with panaceas for the cure of its ills. Tariffs, moratoriums, repudiations, doles, paternalism, individualism, collectivism, socialism, communism. The list could be extended indefinitely. Each and every one of them has its earnest and well-meaning apostles. Let us give them credit for sincerity, but each and all of them are an illusion to the extent that they lose sight of the Masonic, the higher than Masonic law, that men can find permanent happiness only as they predicate their relations with each other on the thought that God is our loving Father, and that all of us, because of that common fatherhood, are brothers. The fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. How often, how glibly, and how thoughtlessly is a phrase on the lips of Freemasons. How reluctant we are to explore its inner meaning. How ineffectually we understand it in all of its implications. Yet it is worthy of our best attention, for it sums up in a few words the combined experience of humanity as to how best man may live happily together and face eternity unafraid. It enunciates the one worthwhile secret of Freemasonry, the one worthwhile secret of a happy life, the only permanent basis of heart's ease for bewildered and suffering humanity. A man worth listening to, some ideas worth pondering. Fans of Johnny Hodges out there? Just pours over you. Sentiment. Lovely. Now we get to turn to symbolism. I think, too, we include ourselves in that process. We are symbols. You think about the thought palaces where we learn and park information. Mind palaces, thought palaces. But today, Brother Colin Dyer takes us to an explanation of the ceremonies. And a context for it, which I truly appreciate, and I think you will too. He claims here, a little more cappuccino, I think. The whole of Masonry is based on progress. And that progress is made in two senses. In the first place, there is the ultimate goal of the progress, the reaching out and constant coming nearer. Nearer to what? To the ultimate perfection, perhaps unattainable in this life, but to come as near to that goal as may be possible. The proliferation of Masonic degrees in the 18th century was perhaps caused by the realization that perfection is unattainable and that however well a man's progress is maintained, there always remains something more to be done, something more to be achieved. Freemasonry has been based on religious beliefs, so far as England, its original home, was concerned. I will let that go. People in Edinburgh and Glasgow, we'll just let that go, please. Those beliefs would be of a Christian and even of an established church character regarding the Bible as its holy book. Masonry used Bible stories in its ceremonies and instructions so that when degrees of a new character were formed or more likely hived off each other, each could take from its theme one more aspect of Bible's history or teaching. Thus, while life lasted, the keen Mason could never become complacent, but must continue to strive. During the early years, before this proliferation, and afterwards too, for the many who were content with the craft degrees alone, the Masonic goal was the perfection of the third degree, symbolized by the old Mason as that perfectly regular structure, the cube. This thought is still expressed in Masonic teaching by the consideration given to the rough and perfect ashlars. These are treated as the immovable jewels of the lodge and are nowadays explained in the first degree. But the inference is still there. The rough ashlar represents the entered apprentice, while the perfect stone of a true die or square, that is a cube that is exact in all its proportions, represents the Mason in the decline of years after a regular, well-spent life in acts of piety and virtue. This perfection of the cube symbolically applied to the individual Mason is wrought by a progression through three degrees. The third of these is seen by some of the old lectures as worked in a lodge symbolically shaped like a cube. For that was the shape of the Holy of Holies in King Solomon's temple, as set out in the Bible. The dimensions are summarized in one of the old lectures. How long was it? 60 cubits. How broad? 20 cubits. How high? 30 cubits, but 20 cubits in length of the west end was only 20 cubits high. What was the place called? Sanctum Sanctorum, or Holy of Holies. The entrance porch was in the east, leading to a main structure whose plan had the shape of a double square. And at the further end, the west, was a room 20 cubits in length and in height and in breadth, forming a cube. Thus, the 3 degrees may be regarded as the progress from outside the porch through the various parts of the temple toward that cube of perfection at the earliest end. The progress. I'll come back. And then he goes on to talk about the theme of the Pilgrim's Progress. But if you have that, you want to do a little bit of deeper reading, let's dust that off before we sit down together again. Our time together is drawing to an end right now. I hope you've enjoyed the program, the content and the process, and some tunes in the meantime. It's been a pleasure. Shout out to all of you, all of the listeners from around the world. Thank you very much for tuning in. Glad we were able to contribute in some small way. Inspiration comes from within. We're sitting back waiting for that epiphany. It comes from within. Don't expect others to give it to you. Don't expect that it's going to be any easier if you're looking at the shortcomings and struggles of other people around you. they, like you, have their own path, their own work to do, their own chores. Whether it's the meager of the world or the exalted of the world, their own choices to make. You and I can enliven that whole conversation, as we should. The world is becoming, if you look around, more urbane. Perhaps in a lot of ways more erudite. I could drive past a field where a farmer is listening to a podcast on Nishi. Why should that surprise me? It shouldn't. Our level of sophistication does increase because our forms of communication are constantly being refined. That's our nature as human beings. The promise of that happiness through a love and appreciation of God, well, that's something that penetrates the soul, doesn't it? If you have one. Or if you're a fan of Dawkins, a listener of Dawkins, it penetrates something in our psyche, perhaps. Anyway, I wish you well over the next couple of days, of course, committing those acts of random sonic kindness, and wrestle with that paradox. How do you do it? How do we do it? I'll go about letting the ethics permeate our being, our actions, our behavior, inside and outside of the lodge, without necessarily claiming responsibility for it. That whole act of an anonymous gesture, that the bigger man, that you do these things, that seems to be applied very economically these days. We want credit, and how do we do that? How do you reconcile that paradox? I think it's simple. Trust other people to discover these things about us without putting it out there in front of them. You don't have to have a shill or advertising. Look what he is doing today for people to discover. Oh, that's not enough anymore? Well, it always used to be. I'll see you in a week. In the meantime, enjoy what's left of the lingering summer solstice. Bye for now. Thank you.
Thank you.